start discussing the mental health element. People alone in their homes looking at screens are desperate for social occasions. And I think this is the open goal for the industry that has been touched upon in the past, as you said, a couple of times, but not universally, not with a unified message. I will also stop fighting the adjacent categories. I think beer, wine, and spirits are all on the defensive now. Maybe it's time to actually try to find some common messages between them, not use every opportunity to, you know, undermine each other and try to get one up just for a couple of months until it becomes a problem.
Welcome to Drinks Insider, the podcast that's interested in everything you can drink. If it's legal, if you can sell it, and more importantly, if you can make money from it, then we're going to talk about it. So come on this journey into the commercial world of everything drinkable. I'm your host, Felicity Carter, and you're listening to Drinks Insider. So, Spiro Malandrakis is the industry manager for alcohol drinks at Euromonitor, where he draws on more than two decades of experience in this space. Euromonitor, of course, being Europe's leading producer of global market intelligence, covering everything from alcohol to dishwashers in India. That means Spiro has a ringside seat as the beverage industry has expanded and is now contracting, a situation he calls the perma-crisis. Spiro, how are you?
Good afternoon to you and to all our listeners. I hope it's going to be an interesting conversation, not just necessarily focusing on doom and gloom, but also providing some opportunities and some hope amidst the darkness.
Well, you know, I was looking you up and you also happen to be a famous actor. Did you know that?
I think it's an interesting, probably some kind of sibling of my parents that somehow found its way, way to
the... Right, it was the golden child. Connection. And you had to go into alcohol studies instead.
Unfortunately, I don't have his hairline. I've missed that. So, you know, we're getting there.
Okay. So you have frequently described the global alcohol industry as being in a state of suspended animation, facing both cyclical and structural headwinds simultaneously. All right. So at what point does the cyclical downturn become permanent? And do you think we're already there?
I think this is the biggest billion-dollar question, if you wish. I've been asking it, asking myself about it for the last couple of years as all of us, listeners and ourselves, are familiar with the crisis plaguing the world, and this is not just about alcoholic drinks anymore, this is much wider. I think the way to describe it is that alcohol, for me, is one of the greatest ways to mirror both macroeconomic developments in society as well as lifestyle shifts and cultural paradigm shifts that sometimes happen in the background. In many cases, they are also the canary in the coal mine when it comes to economic pressures or crisis on the horizon. So, within all that context, we've had the following 2019, we had the great pandemic that was followed by a spike in consumption. I described it back then as the new roaring 20s. Little did I know that the parallels will become many more than just a indulgence-oriented spike after the pandemic. There were many other parallels that raised their heads after that finished. The spike did happen as I predicted it. What I got wrong was my timeline. I thought that the new roaring 20s, as I called it back then, based on the idea that people were staying at home for a couple of years and they missed the socialization element and they missed being around friends and taking part in social occasions, and then, of course, that would lead to that spike. That all happened. What I got wrong was that we are living in an accelerated timeline. So the roaring 20s of a century ago was minimized within 1 or 2 years. So what followed the great pandemic, unlike in 1917, it lasted 3 or 4 years, just like 1917, but we didn't have a whole decade of indulgence-orientated, cabaret-inspired, bacchanalian fun, but actually something that lasted for months less. Still very powerful for a little bit, 1 or 2 years. And then, of course, the inflationary spikes, the geopolitical upheaval, the political upheaval, the trade barriers, that everything else that followed after that kind of killed the momentum of that segment. I hope that kind of provides the background to how I think about the concept of perma-crisis and structural.
So, what do you think the fall in the alcohol market is telling us about economics generally?
I think that is at the core of what I'm saying, that basically my idea at the moment, that's what I'm basically playing around with in my head, is that we need to reconsider the timelines of cyclicality. So historically, when we talk about cyclical crisis, we tend to mean about 6 months, a year, a couple of years. I think we need to conceptualize, start considering the possibility that this cycle, if it is a cycle, it's going to be a very, very long cycle. I'm not entirely sure how long that is, but I can tell you for sure that 2026 is not looking like we have any massive spike. If anything, all the latest information that I'm seeing, I think you saw a couple of days ago, Heineken fired 6,000 people. ABI had the results yesterday. They were even more disappointing than last year. So there is no doubt in my mind that my overall perspective is, if anything, being proven correct by the latest developments. Unfortunately, I wish I was wrong in that. So I think it's going to be a state of permacrisis that will be with us for at least the foreseeable future, the short to the medium term. Now, what happens in another 5, 6, 8 years? Many things can happen. I don't want to go that far. But the cycles that we're talking about, the crisis cycles are becoming much more extended. And in that sense, we might consider them to be structural.
Okay, so you've talked in the past again about the industry being buffeted by what you've called an explosive cocktail of challenges. If you had to rank the three biggest threats right now, cyclical, structural, regulatory, health, wellness, cost of living, inflation, what would be your top threats to the alcohol industry?
I think the macroeconomics in my mind, in terms of short term at the very least, is definitely top of mind. I think this is the major headwind that is stopping everything. And I think in many ways, in my mind, it is actually correlated much more to this kind of much debated distaste that millennials and younger generations and consumers have towards alcohol. I think it's primarily this has to do with their economics, not just their economics, the money in their pockets, but also in terms of their perspective about their future. Because in many cases, even if someone is okay economically, if they feel quite uncomfortable or lack confidence about the next couple of years, they're not going to spend anyway. So I think the macroeconomic environment, the potential for the economy slowing down even further, unemployment going further up, and for any other black swan events being random events that we cannot easily predict at the moment, but they will be related to economics. I think this is definitely, in my mind, number one. Number two would be their lifestyle shifts. And again, this has been debated a lot. I was among the first people that discussed the sober curiosity movement and mindful drinking and no and low alcohol and zebra striping and all these latest terms that come to become trendy in social media once every couple of months to describe essentially this kind of less consumption of alcohol. I think this is ongoing. I see it not necessarily only as a downside risk, but I also obviously see that as an opportunity because many of these brands, the adult non-alcoholic brands, are actually one of the very few segments of the alcohol market right now that provide some momentum and some positive news. So it is a danger, obviously, because the people are drinking less, but at the same time, I think it also provides an opportunity. So that would be number two. Number three, in my mind, there's many different indicators there that would probably fight for the third position. For example, the rise of cannabis and cannabinoids in the US is a major competitor, as I also predicted a long, long time ago. But it's not necessarily relevant across the planet. I don't see cannabis legalization to gain momentum in the next couple of years. So I don't think this is going to be a planetary issue for the alcohol industry. And also it can be an opportunity to the extent that alcohol companies can actually be active within cannabis. I think without having the medical proof at this stage, what would keep me up at night when it comes to the future of alcohol would be the exact effect of GLP-1 medication, the Ozempics of the world, Mounjaros of the world. Initial suggestions are that they have a significant effect
consumption. Push back a little bit on this because I hear everybody talking about it and they've made a big wave in the packaged food market. And I think a lot of the conversation that's happening is because of what's happened in food. But we're primarily talking about junk food. So if you're Nabisco or you're Heinz, you're probably really panicking right now. But one of the things I keep coming back to is GLP-1s are primarily for people who've got diabetes type 2. And that is a group of people that were probably moderating their alcohol consumption anyway. Now, we know that there are people getting around the medical system. There are people using it for cosmetic purposes. That will widen as we start to get pills. But have you got any evidence that the GLP-1s are actually impacting the alcohol market at the moment, as opposed to worrying that they will?
Two things, and they're valid points, obviously, and I always welcome counterpoints. I think that's the best way to approach this kind of questions, because there's no black and white answers. Yeah, and I said this, we have to be very careful with that because we're both not medical experts. One of the major things to remember is that the effect of GLP-1 medication is on highly calorific content, and it's not about, I mean, obviously the junk food is highly calorific by definition, but it's the calories that's the problem, not the quality of the food.
I disagree with that. There's a lot of research that GLP-1s are actually changing people's taste, that they're losing a taste for junk or packaged foods and actually preferring whole foods.
The reason for that, suggestions are exactly because unconsciously it's the calorific element that is making them dislike certain things. The problem in that, even if it is or not the case, is that alcohol does not have alternatives. Food has a wide range of products that can go, obviously alongside portion control, which can be a part of something that alcohol can do as well. But alcohol is ethanol. I know that the industry, you know, talking to beer or talking to wine or talking to spirits, they will always say that they're entirely different. But in reality, it's ethanol. And that's it. There is no step back to take if ethanol somehow doesn't work. Now, I don't expect that to be the end of the alcohol industry in any way. But I have seen some initial research suggesting that when it comes to the high consumers of alcohol, less so on the moderate consumers of alcohol, when it comes to the people that drink, not necessarily, you know, alcoholics or anything, but they are actually heavy consumers. That's when initial research, medical research that I have seen, very, very small samples, suggest declining consumption of 20 to 40 to 60%, which is a very, very, very high figures.
Yeah, though I would say that could actually be in an environment where the alcohol industry as a whole is under a lot more regulatory scrutiny, for it to be losing its heaviest drinkers where most of the damage is done is not necessarily a bad thing.
That's why we have to be very careful about how we position that, obviously. And there's the question, what is the extent? And I've had anecdotal conversations as well with people that are taking GLP-1s, not diabetic in any way. They're doing it simply to lose weight. And they have told me that they have noticed that on themselves. They didn't stop drinking, but their daily couple of glasses of wine became one glass of wine every couple of days, or having one cocktail every week instead of having three.
So I'm going to keep coming back to the fact this is anecdote.
Yes, of course, absolutely. Absolutely.
So, but have you seen any research that suggests, I mean, I've read the research about how it impacts the desire for alcohol and so on, and I've read the New York Times articles about people in Manhattan buying little teeny tiny cocktails and so on, but is there any research at the moment that the GLP-1s are having a major impact on the alcohol market, or is this something that we're worried about for the future?
It is mostly, I have seen only very small samples. And as we know, you need much bigger samples to have a final decision. But I said, this is what keeps me up at night for the future. At the moment, I don't think they have had a major effect. I think most of the effects that we're seeing at the moment are primarily for all of the other reasons that we will cover today. We already mentioned, but in terms of the next couple of years, and again, a reminder to our listeners that, and you mentioned yourself, Felicity, as well, that this is the year that these products become generic, which means prices go massively down.
They do in China and India. They don't within North America or Europe.
Not yet, yeah. But it is, you know, like all generic drugs, they obviously by definition...
They go generic, I think, in 2030, so there's...
There's a couple of years. We have some time. But additionally, they were not going to be injectable. So that the moment they become pills, again, become much more democratized. Again, I'm not a medical expert, and I hope I'm wrong on that. It is something to look. But in terms of the three priorities where we should focus on, it's definitely the economy, it's definitely lifestyles, and it is definitely that potential iceberg on the horizon that we need to be able to swerve around or find ways to tackle it if it happens or if it is proven to be the case that it's a problem.
So, you know, one of the interesting things about economic downturns is usually you get people rather than exiting the category, they trade down. And what we're seeing at the moment is we're seeing that the low entry level beer is disappearing, you know, the vast Riverland and poor quality vineyards in Bordeaux. You know, the lower segment is the one that's actually suffering at the moment. So to me, that seems very paradoxical. Have you got an explanation for that?
I think much of the data that you are seeing at the moment refer to up to last year. I think we have started seeing the first signs, for example, of the economy segment in beer, not in wine. And on wine, you are completely correct, and we can touch upon that separately. When it comes to beer, we have the first signs of some momentum. I'm not saying that it's skyrocketing or anything like that, but some momentum being built in economy beer in a number of markets, which historically for the last 10, 15 years was something completely beyond consideration. So the first signs of that trading down is already there. Additionally, when it comes to beer, there's the extra complication that we have to always remember is that a premium beer is a trading down option from other premium segments.
Really?
So if someone is, yes, because if you're a drinker of premium wine or if you're a drinker of premium whiskey, drinking a premium beer is a trading down option.
Is that right? But so it's not that people trade up to premium beer, it's that it's a substitution for a different category entirely.
Obviously, you can always provide that opportunity. And I think that's why beer tends to be the most, nothing is safe, but it can actually prove to be much more resilient than other segments that by definition, in terms of affordability, as you can imagine, a very expensive, you know, bottle of gin or a very expensive Bordeaux wine is not as affordable as a premium beer. A premium beer is affordable to almost everyone, except, you know, if the circumstances are extreme. So that explains the beer side of things. I think when it comes to wine, for example, I think that gets more interesting. My understanding right now about what's happening is wine on the lower end is that simply the lower end of demographics consuming wine are entirely leaving the wine category, are just trading out instead of down. And I think that is potentially even more problematic because they are completely giving up on the category rather than.
Do you know why? Why?
Because I think wine is increasingly associated with, as you probably also know, that it has had this elitist associations for a number of years, losing touch with younger generations. The older demographics that still consume it either go for something really good, or if they cannot afford something really good, they just leave the category entirely. It's just the cheap wine does not have the momentum, the brand equity, or the support mechanisms at the moment to actually continue navigating this kind of problems that we're describing now, the economic issues that we're describing now.
So one of the discussions that I've had with a lot of people is that the loss of entry-level products is actually killing the wine trade. So I had a really interesting conversation at Wine Paris this week where an innovation specialist actually said they know that young people don't like the taste of wine, or certainly don't like the taste of dry wine, that you need a bridging product. And those bridging products can either be something like Moscato, which is very, very sweet, or you get the new products like XXL, which are, you know, high in alcohol, high in sugar, but they've also got aromatized fruit flavors. And so the fruit flavor is something familiar and it's kind of a door opener. And so my mate Jeff Siegel thinks that the loss of these kinds of products and the disdain for these kinds of products has actually had an effect on bringing people into the category. But that's just a theory. What do you think?
I completely agree, but I would go even a step further. There is no doubt in my mind that the loss of a stepping stone for consumers to eventually graduate to these premium products is definitely missing in wine, and it's missing more and more as the lower end is disappearing. But for me, I always said, and I know that this sentence is probably anathema to our friends in wine, I think that consumers are drinking alcohol with their eyes, not with their mouths. So I was never a believer that the major or key decision mechanism is flavor profiles. I believe that the key decision mechanism is alcohol as an extension of our personal brand.
It's interesting because XXL works really well on TikTok. It's a prop rather than being... Okay, can you unpack that a bit more? What do you mean by being an extension of the self?
I mean that I see and have always seen the alcohol industry as something much more akin and adjacent to the fashion industry rather than to foods. When someone is a decade ago used to hold a craft beer in their hands, they were saying to their friends, their partners, the people around them in the bar or in their house, that they're sophisticated, they do their research, and they always try to find the latest and greatest, you know, most innovative product that actually, you know, has the flavor profile and the hard work gone into it. If someone buys a premium or super premium product, they're also saying they're aspirational. They are successful, or they would like to be successful. It's a status symbol. Equally, when it comes to wine, because of the association that we mentioned earlier, you're telling the other person, oh, I'm sophisticated. You know, I'm drinking that because I know. And most people are quite intimidated by the famous wall of wine in a shop, but I can actually navigate that. I know my way around, and that's what this says about me. Equally, you know, one of the funny, you know, new generation wines or RTDs, it's like I am aware, or the orange wine, I'm aware of the latest trends or biodynamics, but I don't take myself too seriously. All of these things is like wearing an outfit in my mind. So the adjacency is fashion, not foods.
So why have all those signals stopped working? Because it's, you know, craft beer is also in massive decline as well.
Craft beer is in massive decline because the outfits and fashion is changing. So the idea of having the time and the energy to queue outside a brewery in the middle of nowhere, waiting for the latest release in a very geeky kind of way, does not really make sense when it comes to 2026. It did make sense in 2016. We had a much easier and much more straightforward life back then. But equally, and more importantly, when it comes to fashion, fashion is very, very cyclical. And we never like to wear the clothes that our parents used to wear. It's just not cool. What is cool is to wear what our grandparents used to wear. Mm. So it tends to go around in these kind of cycles. So because now the people, the millennials that were queuing outside the breweries in California 10, 15 years ago to get the latest and greatest of the craft, the concoctions, they have kids now. They're not cool anymore. So their kids need to find something new. What they are finding right now is non-alc and obviously the growing segment of RTDs. And I would also like to have a little stop on that as well, because it's referring to something that we mentioned earlier as well. I went back and I tried to understand the history of RTDs over the years. And I realized that they began in the late 70s, early 80s with the first generation or the first iteration of RTDs, which were wine coolers.
Mm, that's right.
Because apparently California had an overproduction of wine, kind of like now. And a couple of friends were sitting by the beach. They had some extra juice. They decided to combine it. It was fun, very unpretentious. It became massively successful very randomly. It lasted for 4 or 5 years, a cycle, which is exactly the timelines that they always last. But my learning from that is less about the RTDs and as an assumption I have about the love affair of the boomer generation with wine. And it is essentially, probably you can see what I'm getting with that. That was their stepping stone to the points that your friends were making about, you know, you need an entry-level product that will allow you then to gravitate to something more premium. The boomer generation, or at least many in the U.S. of the boomer generation, they started by drinking very unpretentious juice and cheap wine concoctions called basically wine coolers. And these are the same people that now in their 60s drink very, very expensive wine. But that's how you begin. You don't begin at the top end.
Well, some people do. You know, it depends on what you're exposed to and what your peer group does. But you're right. I've often wondered, and I've never seen this mentioned except by me, this is my idea, whether the whole wine mum thing was actually catastrophic, not just for women's health, but also because their kids don't want to do what Instagram mum used to do 10 or 15 years ago. What do you think?
Absolutely. I think it did provide some momentum while it worked. Obviously, because the wine industry has been facing issues for a number of years now. So they tried to make the most of what they could potentially reach. So in that sense, probably it postponed the inevitable a little bit. But if we then subscribe to my idea about alcohol as fashion, a mommy juice can never, ever be cool to their kids. I mean, that's the nature of life and generations.
Yeah, it's interesting. So I follow, as you probably know, I follow the health discussion very closely. And there's a whole genre of literature called quit lit about people talking about how they've abandon alcohol. And there's a lot of podcasts. And what I find really interesting is that a lot of those podcasts, a lot of those books are written by people who used to be wine mums who said, you know, there's this belief that wine can't do you any damage, but they're like, I got up to drinking two bottles a day, my health was wrecked, my whatever. They're actually now leading the health charge, which is interesting. All right, so let's go back to talking about premiumization. The premiumization story is really interesting. Everybody's talked about it, but now we're seeing depremiumization happening. We're seeing it in tequila. We're seeing it in all sorts of categories. Was premiumization a mistake, or was it just inflation, or was it a good idea?
I think it was a great idea for as long as it lasted. The problem that we are facing right now is that a lot of the alcohol industry is currently led by people that were simply not around before premiumization was a thing. So we have the lack of imagination or of understanding of what else could there be out there. If you've had a trend for so long, as premiumization has been going now for 15, 20 years, it's so long that it's, in many cases, most of people's careers, like they were not around before premiumization. The parallel I would make is basically being a banker around the end of 2007, somewhere in London, and thinking that surely the markets can only go up. Now, I'm sure it was great as long as they were going up, but you need to have an understanding that this is not infinite, that the fact that you have been witnessing something for a very long time does not make it a linear line that just goes one way. And I think many people fail when it comes to imagining a world beyond what they have always experienced.
Yeah, it's interesting that you say that. I've had discussions with bank analysts about this, about how shocked I am at some of the leadership within the alcohol industry. And I think it's because for 30 years it's only been expansion. And I think there's no memory of what happens, and there's no institutional memory of what happens in a downturn. Now, if you're in media, we've had nothing but downturn for 15 years.
Exactly.
You end up being quite resilient. And you know, one of the lessons of it is you either get out or you adapt. And I think certainly in the wine trade, they're still in shock rather than thinking about adaptation. I mean, that's a generalization. There are some people, obviously, who are doing very well.
Absolutely.
But actually, on this question of leadership, when you look across the alcohol industry, it has been a shock to the system. How much do you see this year in terms of recovery and people picking themselves up and making the decisions that they need to take? And how much do you think there's still a lot of denial about what's happening?
I think we're going through the five stages of grief at this stage. It's still a process. I think there is many people in the alcohol industry across the different sides of it that still largely refuse to acknowledge the bigger structural issues. Many suggest that it's just cyclical. And I've asked this question as well, like when we started, the same question we started with. Like, even if it is cyclical, how long does it cycle end? And it's always like a blank stare back because they just don't have an answer. It's just this kind of hope-induced delusion, I would call it. Again, that doesn't mean that opportunities are not going to be there. And I think I have an idea that I've been playing with my head about where we go from here in terms of positive things for the alcohol industry as well. But I do think that we need to acknowledge the problem first. As we mentioned earlier, some thousands of people being fired in the last week alone, and ABI just also announcing the results yesterday, quite disappointing. Most of the spirits companies, the same. Very few good news out of the wine industry.
Okay, so how much of this do you think is a management issue? Like, if you look at spirits, for example, they just stocked up. There's just too much sitting in barrels and whatever. They over predicted the market. How much of this is just they got the numbers wrong, and how much is it that the market has fundamentally changed in ways that they couldn't predict?
I think I need to give, especially with the spirits guys, I need to give them a little bit of some leeway. And the reason is that spirits, by definition, only operate in terms of decades, not in terms of years or months. So, you know, they have to be at a distillery, making some kind of assumptions about the next 20 years. And in my mind, making any assumption for the next 20 years in the world as it is right now in 2026 is a fool's errand. I'm always very careful to predict anything beyond the next 2 or 3 years. So I need to acknowledge that this is an extremely volatile environment. Nobody could have predicted the pandemic. Nobody could have predicted exactly what's happening in the US at the moment, whatever that is. You know, the state of the world right now is an extremely fluid state. So I have to give them that. At the same time, I think to this day, even as we speak, there's a very high degree of complacency and hope as a strategy. And I always say, hope is not a strategy. Hope is hope. We should have it, but it doesn't change anything. So I think we still have a little bit of that momentum going in that direction. Yes.
Yeah, people should come over to media where you just abandon all hope. you learn how to cope. All right, let's talk about the non-alcoholic sector because, you know, I've just come back from Wine Paris and everybody's talking about non-alcoholic and, you know, it's very exciting and it's in growth. But when I look at it, it actually reminds me a lot of the English sparkling wine category where a lot of people piled into it without thinking about what the demand actually was and what the distribution was. To me, it looks like there's too much excitement about this category. And, you know, there are people who were having stands who got established very early on, the brands that you all know, particularly from Germany. And then there were a lot of others. And I think what I've noticed is that it's very hard for people selling non-alcoholic, whether it's through a dedicated store or whether it's through a dry pub in Scotland or whatever. They don't stay open for very long. You still need to support it with alcohol sales. Well, I mean, that's my opinion. What's yours?
You mentioned a couple of things there that are obviously key here. Yes, so I can start with the dry venues and dry events and all of that. Like, sober curiosity and mindful drinking were never about teetotalism. They were always about moderation. And I think we need to separate these two things, which is, in a way, answering the question about what happens to these dry venues that very, very optimistically open up and then only to close down a couple of months later. So it was never about people never touching alcohol. There is the percentage that do that, obviously. I'm not saying that they don't, but the main momentum behind these products, and in many cases now they start realizing it, and I've seen, for example, recently, I don't remember which brand it was, that was promoting their brand in January, which is dry January, but they were saying that, you know, have a drink. You know, it's not, we're not, we shouldn't just completely be off alcohol, have our non-alcoholic drink, but on another special occasion, do have that drink. And I think it's moderation versus teetotalism that is a key point here that does make a difference. When it comes to saturation, yes, I would agree we have a lot of brands right now. I don't necessarily think the number of brands is currently the problem. My main problem with that is that it is, which is funnily enough, a parallel with sparkling English wine. It's almost a category across non-alcoholic beer, non-alcoholic spirits of all kinds, almost everything, with very, very few exceptions, they are positioned within this premium and super premium segment only. Mm. For me, this is the major, major danger, obviously, because especially in the context we're describing now, but even in normal economic circumstances, but especially in the context we're describing now. So what you're trying is you're trying to educate consumers to move out of a category or a couple of categories that have existed for the last 8 to 10,000 years into something that they don't know, but they need to pay as much or in some cases even more than an alcoholic product. And I think that can prove to be the Achilles heel for this category. And I've been shouting it from the rooftops for a while now. But again, my voice can easily be lost in this premiumization.
Yeah, I mean, the other thing hysteria. Is, as somebody who's, you know, like everybody else, I'm moderating, I'd like non-alcoholic options. But a lot of them, in wine, they're terrible. In beer, I don't drink beer. So the one that I would be most likely to drink are the spirits analogs, but they are full of sugar. They're actually really bad for you.
Some, when it comes to the formulation, and again, I don't want to mention specific brands because I'm trying to be, at least to be agnostic when it comes to what I'm saying publicly, but I think the key direction of all of these products, when we're talking about the future, you mentioned analogs and you mentioned, we could call them, you know, products that, you know, emulate something else or they try to, you know, follow their footsteps. But I think the future is not going to be just products that take out the ethanol out of the equation, but actually products that add some kind of functionality. So products
I was going to ask you about functional drinks. Let's talk about that now.
Yes, yes. I think it's kind of organically as well related one to the other. Some of these products, in my mind, the rise of cannabinoid-infused products in the US, which have been skyrocketing, mostly hemp, less THC because they're using a a way to sidestep the federal laws, but they have been skyrocketing in the US for the last 2 years now. In many cases, account for a significant percentage of the sales of many of the shops that actually do sell them, even in the on-trade. And the effect is very clear, because the argument is you cut down on alcohol, you can do it during dry January. They don't have any calories. They don't have a hangover. And you get something out of it. You get a buzz. It's not the same buzz. And that's why I don't think cannabinoid-infused products focus on exactly the same occasions. I consider them to be much for less social and more for other maybe activities you do alone, or you focus, you know, watching a movie or something like that. But again, they provide something. And also in the UK and in Europe, we've seen some of these products adding nootropics or adaptogenics, like lion's mane, ingredients that are, again, debatable to what extent they actually have.
Yeah, I mean, this is the problem I have with this. I think a lot of these claims are just bullshit, to be honest. There's no clinical yes. science behind them, and nobody knows if they work if they're suspended in drinks anyway.
I do agree with that, and that is one thing I cannot push back in any way. But ultimately, sometimes the placebo effect as well is as powerful as the strongest medication or substance. They seem to have much better in establishing a degree of brand equity than many of these kind of
Do you think as they gain market share that there'll be some sort of regulatory scrutiny, particularly of the claims that are being made?
But I think we've had this conversation before. I just don't believe
We haven't on Drinks Insider, Spiros.
Not live on air. Not live on air. And it's always more fun on air. I've had these conversations for the last 15 years of people suddenly once a year or twice a year. It's people in specific positions in alcohol companies that spend their entire lives lobbying and reading the latest when it comes to legislation. And they're always in a state of panic about how just next month there will be tobacco-style packaging or advertising will be banned everywhere, or ideas that just are obviously floated and then just taken back. And every time I've been telling them that the alcohol industry is providing such immense amounts of tax value to the states, and most of the states across the West are actually bankrupt these days. That I always use this example of Japan. You must be aware of about 2 years ago, after years of anti-alcohol campaigns, that like everyone else and lobbying and all that, consumers in Japan started drinking much less. So about a couple of years ago, what did the government do when consumers did what everyone is afraid they will do? They actually crowdsourced ideas. They asked people to give ideas about how to make people drink more. Because when push comes to shove, alcohol is not tobacco. It's never going to be tobacco. And even in cases where alcoholism levels are very, very high, like in Ireland, for example, in the last couple of years, and I follow these developments as well, obviously, they had these plain packaging approaches and having the carcinogenic signs on the labels. What happens? Oh, the economy collapsed, and now we have the trade barrier, so we're just going to postpone it for a couple of years. It's just not going to happen now, maybe at some point in the future. So it has never really happened. I don't think...
Yeah, you say that, Spiros, but, you know, it is gathering momentum. I mean, there's a bill going through Canadian Parliament at the moment. The National Health put out a 10-year plan last week. Page 40 recommends, you know, and the British government is very much a nanny state government at the moment. They're imposing all kinds of things. I don't think these things happen quickly, but the momentum really is building internationally for, you know, cancer-style warnings.
I think there is a momentum for medical recommendations. I think that will potentially happen, and it has happened in Canada. My question is, will there be legislation about plain packaging or carcinogenic labeling? I'm much more skeptical about that, and I'm even more skeptical about the effect of official recommendations towards the way consumers drink in 2026. If we are talking about the French paradox in the 80s versus how consumers think about alcohol in 2026, especially younger consumers that basically live their lives on TikTok. I don't think any health organization suggesting that you have to, you know, all alcohol is bad for you suddenly will make all 25-year-olds stop to drinking their RTDs. I don't think that's going to be the way it plays out. Again, maybe I will be proven wrong, but I am yet to see something actionable. It has been gaining momentum for the last 15 years of discussions I've been having. Has given great opportunities for great debates in many conferences around the world for the last 15 years, and that's about it for me personally. I think that it is a problem we have to face, but the industry at the moment needs to face our house.
Yeah, there's other things. There's also what you can control and what you can't. I do disagree with you on the momentum around legislation. I think it's gathering pace, but I do agree that the industry can't think about that. It's too big a deal. It has to think about other things. All right, so let's talk about cannabinoid.
If I may say something on that, there is a counter argument that the industry has started to navigate or create a narrative around. Unfortunately, in my mind, has lost the opportunity for a number of years because it was baited into getting into the debate of the physical health. So every time there's a new report about the J curve of consumption and carcinogenic effects or not, and they start digging deeper into exactly how the research was done and trying to provide counter-arguments on the physical elements of it, which is fine and fine to do. But along the way, they're missing the obvious, in my mind, opportunity, which is the mental health elements, which nobody is really touching upon. The world right now is going completely insane. Societies,
Well, don't forget, Heineken has done a big campaign around that. I mean, I think that push is beginning to happen around sort of...
It's only wine also had recently... come over October, I believe they called it, an opportunity for wine to become a pillar of socialization, basically, again, and finding this place. But we live in a world that everyone is massively polarized, societies are massively polarized, the loneliness epidemic is killing people around the world. And again, alcohol would never be the solution, it's not a medical substance, but having a beer, as you suggested with Heineken doing it, or having a glass of wine, is something that has severely been underutilized, and also the industry hasn't really sat around and to have its unified voice to touch upon that. So I think that's, we're going to see much more of that.
All right. What about packaging? What are you seeing in terms of, you know, smaller serving sizes and innovation there, and how much do you think it will impact the market?
I've only started seeing the first signs of that. Again, these are sometimes I see trends in their infancy. It doesn't mean that it's something that's going to be universal or we see it everywhere, but I do expect it to become much more prominent going forward. So smaller sizing, so downsizing. Downsizing can provide the opportunity both for a moderation forward approach, so you drink less by definition, it's smaller, but also provide some kind of reply and answer to the affordability question, especially when it comes to premium variants. We've had a couple of spirits, a couple of examples in tequila, for example. I believe Patron just a few months ago came out with a tiny bottle exactly created for younger consumers on the go that have affordability questions. This is perfectly positioned to every single other trend that we mentioned before. Similarly, I started hearing about mini cocktails, essentially shooters, in a couple of trendy bars in New York and California. Again, as sophisticated as a proper cocktail, but essentially as big as a shot, and hence much more affordable. So this kind of combination, the downsizing, is something I would expect to see much more in the future.
Okay, in the time that we've got left, Spiros, you have just become CEO of a big alcohol company. What changes are you going to make sure that you're still there in 30 years?
First of all, deep breaths and don't panic. I think that's always that's what I have to remind them sometimes. Alcohol has been around for a very long time. I don't expect it to go down the way that tobacco did. I expect it to continue being around. That's the first most important thing to keep in mind. I would, and as I have suggested many times in the past, double down on RTDs, double down on both RTDs as a growth engine, but also as a stepping stone for all of the other segments that we mentioned earlier. So if I want to keep people into my ecosystem down the line, I need to provide an opportunity to either trade down or at least experiment with them or get the millennials and Generation Z on board. So RTDs, 100%. And that would be spirit-based.
But Spiros, your beer division has just come to you and said, what are you saying? We can't do RTDs.
Well, I can tell you they can. They definitely can. Even if it requires some more investment, it is an investment that needs to be done because at the moment, there's not many segments that are actually growing. This is it. Like, you either jump on board or you miss the train. I think that's the stage that we're in. Non-alc, obviously, in terms of growth engines as well, but specifically when it comes to functionality, I wouldn't really try to replicate any of the alcohol categories. I think the effects are always kind of meh. As you were talking about wine earlier, it doesn't really have that effect. Having some actual functional benefits, to the extent that it can be measurable, that would be much better as well. But most importantly, I would keep all the categories that I have before. I expect, in terms of, if you want more abstract or philosophical themes, the world that we lived until today for the last 20 or 30 years has been a world in the hands of globalization. That world is largely ending right now, or it's going through a massive transition. So I expect the importance of lack of local and national specialties to become even more pronounced in the next couple of years as trade barriers, embargoes, trade wars, physical wars, dynamic wars, everything that's happening in between is shifting people inwards. The rise of nationalistic politics and policies and political parties around the world, and again, alcohol is always reflecting of undercurrents in society and lifestyle, are also parallel to that. So, you know, doubling down on products that are coming, have authentic histories that are coming from certain markets, and they are actually capitalizing on that history. That might be a cachaça in Brazil, it might be Baijiu in China, it might be a locally produced gin, or it might be a locally produced whiskey, a world whiskey, as we call it, that does not necessarily come from Scotland. So, you know, that doubling down on specifics when it comes to the markets that they are coming from. That's another kind of more generalist approach. The thing I would like to also remind them is the way of speaking. And we already mentioned that. How do we speak about that? Alcohol, leave the conversation about physical and medical effects to the professionals. Obviously, support independent research, you know, not biased in any way. And we should always welcome that. But start discussing the mental health element. People alone in their homes looking at screens are desperate for social occasions. And I think this is the open goal for the industry that has been touched upon in the past, as you said, a couple of times, but not universally, not with a unified message. I will also stop fighting the adjacent categories. I think beer, wine, and spirits are all on the defensive now. Maybe it's time to actually try to find some common messages between them, not use every opportunity to, you know, undermine each other and try to get one up just for a couple of months until it becomes a problem. And ultimately, finally, and I think that is an idea that might sound a little bleak or strange as a first step, but it actually is also an opportunity at the same time. It's an idea of a trend that I start seeing the first signs of as we speak. I haven't even written about it, so you're one of the first. I've only talked to a couple of journalists about it yet, but you're one of the first that has the chance to hear it. And that is that in a world, in a state of perma-crisis that we described in the beginning of our conversation, especially when it comes to younger consumers and drinkers, but also across the board, there will be a questioning of this health-forward monolithic perspective that has seemed to be, you know, dominating all discussions in the alcohol industry in the last couple of years. I call it that the rise of nihilistic indulgence. So that's my new concept.
Nihilistic indulgence.
Yes. So that's what I said. You have the chance to hear it among the first. So the idea is that in the last few months, I've started seeing news stories of Gen Z consumers for the first time in the last decade decline to take part in Dry January or Dry October. And the answer in surveys, it wasn't Euromondo survey, because I'm trying to read everything and talk to everyone, by the way. It's just, you know, in anecdotal discussions and also with the industry itself. Many times the reply was, why would I do that if I don't see a future?
Well, actually, so a colleague of mine, Pauline, was in London and she went to an event. She said it was £28 and it was mostly people under 30. And she said they were all smoking.
That is the second point I wanted to make. And you're absolutely correct. Also, 2 weeks ago, the Wall Street Journal had an article specifically that for the first time in the last 10, 15 years in the US, there was an uptake in the levels of actual old school tobacco smokers among young people. This hasn't happened in the last 10, 15 years. And the rise of what they call cigfluencers, cigfluencers from cigarettes, something that even a couple of years ago, especially in a country like the US, which where smoking is completely out, nothing to do with it, is a sign of something. And again, when they were asked about that, the answer was exactly the same. Why would I stop smoking if I don't see a long-term future?
No, that's actually terrible. That's not something to look forward to. But I'll tell you something else I saw. So a bank analyst rang me up once and said, you know, what did I think about the future of fine wine? And I said, look, fine wine will always be okay. If you look at cigarettes are stigmatized. Cigars never were because status always stays status. And she actually said to me, well, in her lifetime, she grew up in a place in Italy where the fur trade was really important. And in her lifetime, she'd seen the fur trade completely disappear. And of course, it's a much older trade than the wine trade. It's gone on for 120,000 years. Well, I was in Eastern Europe over Christmas and I saw people wearing fur coats everywhere. I guess it's very cold there, but the stigma, I mean, and this is awful as well. I'd like to see fur go away permanently, but the stigma against fur seems to have started to disappear.
Yes. These things are cyclical. And yeah, I mean, we obviously agree about the fur trade in any way, but I can attest to what you're just... Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. But I can attest to what you're saying, you know, the different perspective when it comes to different cultural places around the world. And again, I'm not suggesting that nihilistic indulgence is a good thing, but it is, again, our job is not to have any moral judgment, ultimately. Our job is to predict the future. So this is what I'm seeing rising, and that could be, and it will inevitably be, also an opportunity for alcohol. That doesn't mean it's an opportunity to make people drunk to forget their problems. I'm just saying that this kind of monodimensional positioning of everything needs to be healthy, everything needs to be about less alcohol.
Yeah, well, it's certainly true that austerity never lasts very long. I mean, if you look at historically, you can see the actual Puritans and then it's followed by the Restoration Court. You know, we don't like austerity for too long, cold plunges and
So we might be in the beginning of that uptake of that new trend.
All right, I think that's positive. I think the idea of nihilistic drinking is not positive any more than smoking or fur coats are positive.
I know.
But I guess we've ended on a sort of positive note for the. Not sure. A sort of a horrifying
I think it's most one thing to provide some food for thought or some drinks for thought for our listeners. And I think at the very least, that will initiate some very interesting discussions. Even the pushback, I always welcome it. And again, as I said,
I'll put your email address in the show notes so you can get inundated with people yelling at you. All right. Spiros, thank you so much for your time this afternoon.
It was an absolute pleasure. Looking forward to it. To the next time as well.
You've been listening to Drinks Insider, the podcast that explores the intersection of beverages and commerce. Now, if you would like a summary of this episode, sign up for the Drinks Insider newsletter, which sends you the takeaways. Just go to drinksinsider.com and add your name. And if there's something you think we should be talking about, drop me a line at felicity@drinksinsider.com. And before you go, please don't forget to rate this podcast. 5 stars are most welcome. Thank you.